Welcome to Weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, do you call it the Affordable Health Care Act, or do you call it Obamacare? The answer to your question probably also indicates where you fall in the raging controversy that rages across our country and in the courts today, and that is, of course, the battle over the new health care statute. I'm going to be talking about the constitutionality of that statute, an issue that is heading straight for the United States Supreme Court even as we speak. And I'll have a couple of very interesting people to talk to in just a few minutes. We'll be talking to Larry Jacobs, who is a professor who studies healthcare law. And we'll also be talking to Ed White, who is a lawyer who is advocating against this statute. In the meantime, I have with me one of my former students, Drew Taylor, who's going to help me explain this situation. Drew, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me, Professor.
Absolutely. We're very happy to have you with us. Now, what is this Affordable Health Care Act?
Well, Professor, the Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act, or the PPACA, is actually a federal...
The PPACA.
Yes, sir, that's
no,
correct.
No, they walked right into that, didn't they? Obamacare, whether you're for it or against it, that's just a much pithier way to describe it, isn't it?
That's exactly right. The PAPACA, for short, is a federal statute that they signed into law, or rather, President Obama signed into law, March 23rd of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with this law, or I guess the beauty of this law, depending on which side you stand on, is that it's going to mandate every person in the United States to have health insurance.
Hmm.
Now, as we all know, health insurance is one of those things where you have to spread out your costs.
Right, like any insurance.
Like any insurance.
Right.
And with this particular plan, you are going to have every single member of the United States, every single citizen, man, woman, and child, to get insurance.
That's right. And there are going to be some exceptions. We don't have to go into that right now.
Certainly.
But if you want universal coverage,
yes, sir,
as a goal, then you're going to have pretty much universal premium payment is what it really comes down to, right?
That's it.
That's how you spread the risk and spread the cost. And so what does that mean on a practical level?
Well, that's going to bring in something that we call the individual mandate.
Okay.
And what that is that's when the government makes a person do something. Specifically, now, I've heard some people speak in the past that this is the first time it's ever been done. It has been done before.
Uh-huh.
They had the Militia Act of 1792, I believe it was.
Uh-huh.
And that act required every able-bodied man between the ages of 18 and 45 to have a musket, a bayonet, two spare flints, and a handful of other things so they can fight in their local militias.
Okay, so there have been mandates in the past.
Suffice it to say, that one didn't really survive.
I don't have my flintlock, so I guess I'd be in violation if that were there. So we've had mandates, individual mandates in the past that emanated from the federal government that required us effectively to buy something if we didn't have it, a musket or a flint or whatever. But this is the first one in modern times, isn't it?
Yes, sir, certainly.
And sort of pursuant to the commerce power anyway. In fact, let's talk about that. This is something that has supposedly been enacted. This statute's been enacted pursuant to Congress's power to regulate commerce.
Yes, sir.
Is that What's the problem there? I mean, is that power big enough to cover this or not?
Well, that all depends on what you consider commerce to be, Professor.
Mm-hmm.
In the olden days, commerce used to be anything that crossed state lines.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the Commerce Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8, states that Congress shall have all power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with Indian tribes.
Right.
However, as the years have continued, specifically with the Marshall Court, the Commerce Clause has become far broader than it's ever been in the past.
Uh-huh.
So it really depends on where our court stands on the issue right now.
Okay, so it's not a limitless power.
No, sir, certainly okay. Not.
Every power that Congress has, every enumerated power, has some limit on it somewhere.
That's correct.
But I guess we're all arguing about whether that commerce power in Article 1, Section 8 is big enough, is powerful enough to cover this so-called individual mandate or not.
Yes, sir. That's correct. Pursuant to, I believe it's the 10th Amendment, which stipulates that all powers that the national government doesn't take, the states will retain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another constitutional provision that's often mentioned in all Commerce Clause cases, or I should say many of them. And that the question with that is whether the 10th Amendment creates some kind of exterior limitation on the commerce power and on federal power generally. So that's the other provision that people are tossing about. And the general rule is the broader the commerce power, the broader it's interpreted to be, then the less significant the 10th Amendment is. But if the court thinks the 10th Amendment is very broad itself, is a broad check on the commerce power, then it tends to look at the commerce power as being less powerful. If that's not too confusing. At any rate, that's the constitutional landscape. So we've got this very important statute with a very controversial provision, the individual mandate. And the question is whether the commerce power is broad enough, is powerful enough, in light of the 10th Amendment, perhaps, to make this constitutional or not. Thank you very much, Drew. Appreciate that introduction.
Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for us to speak with Larry Jacobs, who is a professor in the political science department at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Larry is a political scientist who studies broadly American politics, but specifically health reform. And in fact, just last year in 2010, he co-authored a book called Health Reform and American Politics. Well, Larry Jacobs, thank you very kindly for being on the show.
Good to be with you, sir.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you. Now, you have extensive scholarship in the area of healthcare law and American politics. What do you think about this so-called Obamacare plan?
Well, it is a step forward, like any policy you look into. It's far from perfect. This is a work of legislative process, and so there are compromises and so forth. But when you look at it in terms of building on our private insurance system, it continues that, but it creates kind of guardrails to prevent the most egregious kind of shenanigans that we've seen. You know, some folks who paid their health insurance premiums for years, they get ovarian cancer and they were dropped by their insurance company. So we got to put a stop to that. There's some subsidies in there for folks up to $90,000 a year for a family of four so that they can afford the insurance premiums. And then there are a whole lot of cost controls, and I think that's part of what people don't understand is how much thought went into how do we get control of the cost.
Yeah, it's a big issue with healthcare, of course. And, of course, those are all policy concerns, and ultimately that's, you know, what's driving this is people's perception of, you know, whether the system's broken or not and how it should be fixed, if so. But, of course, we're most concerned about the constitutional aspects of this this healthcare act on our show. And so if we could center in on that, please, could you give us your reaction to the arguments that are being made by a number of states that the act is unconstitutional?
You know, one of the things that's interesting about the constitutional debate is that this was anticipated well before the reform was signed by President Obama in March 2010. You can go back at 2008 or 2009 and you find people thinking, okay, if we're going to do reform, how are we going to handle these challenges to the constitutional basis of this? And so I would break the debate into three quadrants or three sections. One is a argument that the entire bill should be nullified, and there's usually a focus on the 10th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, which states the powers are not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states. This is a long-standing argument. You go back to the Civil War and you see it made, and it just has very weak grounds. You've got Article 4 in the Constitution, which talks about the U.S. Constitution, federal laws, being the supreme law of the land. You've got the political case, the Supreme Court cases from the Civil War on, up until our own time, that have struck down these kinds of challenges, particularly in cases where states are not compelled to act, which is the case in the Affordable Care Act. So that's the kind of argument you most hear about in the political debate about nullification.
Right, the Tenth Amendment. We did a whole episode on nullification some time ago, and that's an interesting doctrine. But the fellow I spoke to, who's an expert on this subject, said that in his mind and in the mind of most people who study it, it's sort of a dead letter. It's been revived lately in the political sphere, but most people who look at it don't really see much constitutionality in the nullification argument.
Right, and I think that the appreciate about the law is when you've got, particularly as you move up the levels of the courts, and you get to the appeals courts and then the United States Supreme Court, you find judges who are very much aware of the broader implications of a ruling. And so if for some fantastical reason nullification were to be embraced by, let's say, the Supreme Court, it would have catastrophic implications for all sorts of areas of law. Some of which people may not be focused on, but you'd have business contracts that would be thrown up in the air. You'd have all sorts of, harmful state actions for, individual liberties that could crop up. So I don't think that's a very serious challenge.
No, I was about to say exactly the same thing. It just doesn't seem like a very serious argument to me. So what's interesting about it is how it keeps cropping up again and again. It's kind of like a vampire, and someone keeps pulling the stake out of the vampire's heart, and he revives again.
Well, I would put this in the category of a politically motivated constitutional argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the people who have qualms, some of them legitimate, about the Affordable Care Act and whether it's constitutional, don't give it a whole lot of thought. They might give lip service to it because there are constituencies that are looking for it, but that's not where the energy is going.
Okay, what are the more serious constitutional challenges to the Health Care Act?
Well, we've heard some people, and this really got quite a bit of boost down in Florida with Bill McCollum, who was the Attorney General there and then thought about running for governor. He said that the health insurance exchanges, which is kind of the anchor of the law, and Medicaid were what he described as an unprecedented encroachment on the sovereignty of the states. And that's something we've heard quite a bit of, in fact, that very language. But the problem here is the states are not obligated to sign up with Medicaid. They can choose not to do it. And they're also not obligated or compelled to establish an exchange. They can pass on those things. Now, if they pass on Medicaid, they're giving up on a lot of money. And if they pass on the exchange, then residents in those states can choose to opt into a federal program. So that's another one of those arguments where it doesn't hold a whole lot of water. I think it's people are confused about the law or looking to make political hay.
Yeah, they also mention the Tenth Amendment a lot when they talk about state sovereignty. I mean, Tenth Amendment is something you hear thrown about a great deal, but oftentimes in the context of just there's some sort of limit on what the federal government can make the states do. But as you point out, there's technically speaking, the states are not required to do those things under this act.
Exactly. Now, the bigger area of dispute, and I think this is really where the fight is right now, is over what's known as the individual mandate.
I thought you'd get to that eventually. Yeah, that's probably the single most serious challenge, isn't it?
It is. And basically the idea here is that the government is saying you need to go out and get health insurance, like you need to go out and get car insurance if you're going to drive a car. And the criticism of that that's come about in terms of the constitutional challenge is the idea of converting inactivity of not buying insurance into a commercial activity that can be regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of discussion about whether the government's power, particularly Washington's power, extends to the failure to do something, namely to get health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you feel about that? What are the arguments in that?
Well, I think, again, there's a inclination among many of us to say, yeah, why should I be forced to do this? But when you don't have health insurance, and let's say you're riding your bike and you get hit by a car, you're perfectly healthy, 28-year-old kid who feels like the world's ahead of you and you can conquer anything. Well, there you are, and you get hit by a car, and the ambulance has to come and take you to the hospital. Now, your decision not to get health insurance means that you and me and everyone listening to us is going to have to pay for that. And what we find is that there is enormous cost of those folks who don't get insurance, who could afford insurance, that we're going to have to pick up in our tax dollars and our higher health care costs. This is an idea that conservatives had supported for many years up until the time of the Affordable Care Act in 2010. And the way they described it is individuals taking responsibility for themselves.
Yeah, and in fact, I think that's the theory. Just so we're all clear on this, the idea is that we're all human beings and that we all are going to need health care at some point. We could be healthy today, we can be young today, but at some point everybody gets sick. And under most existing laws that I'm aware of, if somebody gets seriously injured or seriously ill, the hospitals have to treat them. I mean, you can't just leave people lying on the streets to die. And so someone has to pay for that. And so the argument goes that since we're all going to incur these expenses, it's appropriate to require people to take responsibility for that expense up front.
Exactly. And what you've described, though, is a definition that would say there is implicit in us living in our communities the likelihood that we're going to actually have this activity known as healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And the critics are saying, well, there's no activity until you need it. And so essentially we're going to be regulating people to have to do something before they need it. And that's where there's been a lot of criticism. I think, and again, this is one of the areas where the reformers were thinking ahead. They tried to peel off what might be simple or kind of easy, low-hanging fruit in terms of this argument. For instance, there are exemptions for religious objections to being covered by insurance. Also, if you cannot afford to pay the insurance premium, you're also given a waiver.
Right.
So they're trying to peel back, you know, some of the, I would say, the more straightforward arguments about why the mandate that individuals have insurance would apply, and to get into this area where, for a long time, government has acted.
Right. Yeah, and there are a number of cases out there, as I'm sure you're aware, where the government has regulated entire markets, markets for various agricultural goods or markets for illicit drugs, in ways that are rather intrusive. And I'm thinking in particular, of course, of the famous case from the early 1940s, Wickard versus Filburn, where the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938 was being challenged. And that act effectively required farmers to stop growing food for their own consumption on their own property, and therefore effectively required them to go out and purchase flour or bread at the store. That's often considered one of the high water marks of the commerce power, which is the power that's at issue here. And that case has been affirmed repeatedly in the 2000s, in the last decade. That suggests that maybe it's not quite such a huge leap to an individual mandate in the Health Care Act.
Yeah, and if you read through the actual legislation, parts of it read as a dialogue with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, they do. They really try to anticipate these things. But
they actually have in the law things called findings, where they're talking about the cost of this inactivity. And they're describing what they refer to as substantial commerce in the area of health insurance and health care costs, referencing almost the very wording of some of Antonin Scalia's conservative rulings over the past 10 years. There was an important ruling that Justice Scalia had back in 2005, avoiding state laws that have permitted the growing of marijuana.
Well, that was the one I was thinking of. I think that was the Gonzalez versus Reich case. And citing Wickard versus Filburn, the case that I just mentioned. Yeah, so they're tracking Scalia's language, are they?
Yeah, and what's interesting here is the law and the Obama administration, as it's arguing it, is trying to put Scalia and some of the other judges in a comfortable position where if they rule against the Affordable Care Act and the individual mandate, they're going to be undermining important parts of conservative jurisprudence. So So there's a vice that's being applied here, and it's going to be hard for the judges to make a ruling here that doesn't have precedent that will undermine other rulings that they like a lot.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, I think that was sort of the tension they felt in that drug case, because that was, again, a very expansive exercise of the commerce power. So on the one hand, a small government advocate might be very uncomfortable with the Gonzalez case, but on the other hand, if they didn't allow the government to regulate illicit drugs, they were effectively saying that we had to abandon the war on drugs. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. We're talking to Larry Jacobs, a political science professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk a bit more with Larry Jacobs.
Danny was born 10 weeks too soon. Premature baby in the ICU. Could have saved a dollar if he spent a dime. What we did to Danny was a low-down crime. Something's gone wrong, won't you tell me why? The rich folks live and the poor folks die. Living is the thing that money can buy. The rich folks live and the poor folks die.
It's time again for our constitutional quiz, and into our studio strides Kelly Carmichael from the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, Stuart. How are you today?
I am doing extremely well, and I'm very excited to have with me yet another contestant who is eager to demonstrate his knowledge of the Constitution. I'll let the contestant introduce himself.
My name is Patrick.
Our victim,
right. What's your name?
Patrick Anstead from Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Fayetteville, North Carolina. Have you been in the military? Are you a military family?
No, sir. I'm from there originally.
You're just from... I didn't think there was anybody there originally. I thought it was just soldiers and laundromats and movie houses.
And strip clubs.
And strip clubs?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I said, well, just like most military towns. All right, Patrick. Well, Kelly, do you have a good hard question for Patrick today?
Well, Patrick, are you a history buff?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, then I have a great question for you.
All right.
Are you ready?
Yes, ma'am.
Are you sure?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Here we go. Which event finally convinced national leaders of the need for a stronger national government than the Articles of Confederation provided? Which event finally convinced national leaders of the need for a stronger national government than the Articles of Confederation provided? Was it A, the Boston Tea Party, B, Shays' Rebellion, C, the Intolerable Acts, D, Whiskey Rebellion, or E, the Boston Red Sox winning the World Series?
Let me just give a little bit of background while Patrick is contemplating these choices. The Articles of Confederation, of course, were the document that governed us for the first 11 years of our national existence. But they were very loosely drafted. They didn't make a strong government. And there was a period of unrest, both economic and political, during the 1780s. And so that's what we're talking about, Patrick. We're talking about that period and what particular event is identified by historians as being the one that really prompted people to come together and want to adopt this this strong national government.
The answer is D, the Whiskey Rebellion.
You didn't even talk about the others. I want to go through them in order before you completely commit yourself. What about the Boston Tea Party?
He seems convinced. He seems like he's ready to do final answer.
No, we can't do that, Kelly. We got to go. We're not going to let this guy hang himself without at least the opportunity to avoid the gallows. So why don't you run through the questions again? The
answer. Hanging himself, though.
Well, we'll see what happens. Could you go through the answer choices again in order, and we'll have Patrick's comment on each one.
Absolutely. Was it A, the Boston Tea Party?
The Boston Tea Party was during the American Revolution.
Okay, well, that's a good answer, or a good rejection of an answer. Okay.
All right, and B, Shays' Rebellion?
I'm not exactly sure what time period Shays' Rebellion took place, but I'm fairly confident that that is not the answer.
Okay. What was the next one, Kelly?
C, the Intolerable Acts.
What about the Intolerable Acts? That sounds like a pretty good reason to...
The Intolerable Acts, I believe, were imposed by the British government on the colonies.
Okay, well, so that's okay. Not your answer?
And then, not but the you right like.
And the next one was D, right?
D, and it sounds like that's what happens in your community where you're from in North Carolina, the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yes, ma'am. I think that was in Pennsylvania, and just Washington's show of force was enough to calm the event.
I see. Okay, so the Whiskey Rebellion, and you don't like the Boston Red Sox?
I'm indifferent.
I don't know. The Boston Red Sox winning the World Series, I think, is grounds enough for us to create a stronger national government.
That is a world-shaking event.
Okay. It is.
So your final answer then is D, the Whiskey Rebellion.
Yes, sir.
Kelly, how did he do?
Patrick, we tried to help you, but actually the correct answer is B, Shay's Rebellion. The Whiskey Rebellion actually happened much later in 1794. So post the Constitution being ratified.
We tried to help you, but you refused our helping hand. I have absolutely no sympathy for you, Patrick.
I guess I don't win the T-shirt.
I'm sorry. And then you
can we give him anything?
Now, I've got a pocket copy of the Constitution from Montpelier.
That's exactly perfect.
It's a consolation prize.
All of our contestants get that, and we're very happy to give it to you. And just to clarify, and I must say, I'm very impressed with your knowledge generally of this era, but what happened is you got a little bit tripped up, and many people make this mistake. Shay's Rebellion happened in early 1787, right before the Constitutional Convention, and it was led by Daniel Shays in Western Massachusetts. He was protesting foreclosures on farms. And that really concerned people because Massachusetts was having difficulty putting it down. The Whiskey Rebellion, as Kelly mentioned, happened later, and it was George Washington who put it down, but it was after he was president under the Constitution. So often people confuse those two, and so no reason to feel ashamed of that, but you will not be able to sport your T-shirt for the ladies. I'm very sorry, Patrick.
That's unfortunate.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking about Obamacare, or if you prefer, the Affordable Health Care Statute. We've been talking to Professor Larry Jacobs of the University of Minnesota. We'll finish talking to him, and then in a little while, we'll talk to Ed White of the American Center for Law and Justice. But first, let's finish our discussion with Larry Jacobs.
Now, I would mention one other thing. Often in these cases, you kind of zero in on particular justices to try to get a read on where they're going to come down. And as in so many cases, Justice Kennedy is one that we're going to follow very closely, and he has a tendency to move between pretty conservative views of the law
mm-hmm.
and pragmatism. And this may be the kind of argument where the pragmatic strain in his thought is going to be pulled at. Because
mm-hmm.
he realizes the vast amounts of money and commerce that are involved in healthcare, and the argument that there's inactivity in a multi-billion-dollar industry is, I think, going to have a tough pull with him.
Yeah, it may very well. But let me play devil's advocate, Larry. If this Health Care Act is affirmed, if the individual mandate is held to be constitutional, if the government can effectively say, if you can afford it and if there's no religious problem, you have to go out and buy health insurance, where does it stop? Is there no limit on what the commerce power can be used for?
Well, I think it's going to be a constant battle as to the limits of the commerce clause and how it's applied. I don't think the judges are going to rule in such a way as to open up a huge area of new law, but the test that they've had up to this point is that there is substantial interstate commerce at stake. And in healthcare, obviously the Democrats feel that that's the case, as do many economists who've studied this for years. And the judges, as they craft the decision, if they were to come down and affirm the individual mandate, would be very careful to narrowly draw the precedent. There's a lot of concern, particularly in the conservative circles, that the Commerce Clause has become a Mack truck in driving through individual rights and liberties.
Yeah, and that's always been a problem. I mean, you can go all the way back to Gibbons versus Ogden in the early 19th century and Chief Justice Marshall. I mean, from the very beginning, the question's always been, where does one draw the line? And, of course, Marshall didn't draw much of a line. Periodically throughout the history of the Commerce Clause, we have pushed back a little bit, but almost always the clause then reasserts itself and just threatens to envelop everything. So if you're worried, if you're a person who's worried about the extent of federal power, then that's certainly a legitimate concern to express in this case.
I think it is. And yet I think there's a real world context here that Justice Kennedy be alert to, as well as a footing here for conservative jurisprudence. Now, I would just mention one other part of this, just to give it a little more realism. When you really dig in on the individual mandate, it doesn't bear much resemblance to what either the advocates for it are saying or the critics. The law, as it's written, doesn't have much of a hammer. And while there may be a precedent here that's going to need to be watched carefully over time, what the actual law says in health reform is that there are first these exemptions we've talked about. The penalty was slashed dramatically, and the Internal Revenue Service that collects our taxes is barred from collecting that penalty.
Huh.
So the individual mandate has hortatory power. It's kind of a symbolic threat, and it's certainly, you know, the most visible challenge to the health reform law. But when you actually dig in on its consequence, it's more about trying to set a tone and scaring people to sign up into law rather than, you know, slapping handcuffs or showing up at someone's door with a fee or a bill that has to be paid.
So even though the penalty for not buying insurance is characterized as a tax, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, if you will, you're saying that the IRS is barred from collecting that particular tax?
Yep, and it's just for the reasons we're talking about. The Senate in particular was concerned that the law not become an onerous burden on individuals with the IRS doing intrusive investigations of those who are not paying up. Now, you got to go pretty deep in the law to discover this, and neither those arguing for the individual mandate nor obviously those who are trying to strike down the health reform as a whole have really cared to talk about that.
No, I rarely hear anything about that, but I can imagine right off the top of my head why the opponents of the bill don't want to mention it because it doesn't help them. And the advocates of the bill are hopeful that it'll be affirmed, but they really don't want to advertise the fact that it's a toothless requirement.
Yeah, and the reason for that is the law will work if just about everybody signs up for insurance. If we get to a situation where folks just sign up for insurance when they're sick, then it'll be unaffordable. We need 90 to 95% of the country signing up for insurance, and then you can kind of spread the risk and the cost out over a very large number of people, and the premiums become more reasonable.
Oh, yeah. Insurance doesn't work if only sick people sign up. But let's talk about that last aspect of it before we go. This penalty for violating the individual mandate, for not purchasing insurance, is described as a tax. And as you know, the taxing power is even more expansive than the commerce power. And it's a sort of a given in law school. In fact, I teach my constitutional law students that if Congress passes a tax and the question is whether it's constitutional, the answer is yes. So, I mean, if the court considers this to be a tax, then it becomes a very easy constitutional question, doesn't it?
It does, and there's language in the law describing it as an excise tax. Now, some of the lawyers and the critics have gone into the debates on the floor, and Democrats made the decision not to describe it as a tax.
Yeah, that was a political decision.
It was a political decision. They didn't want to kind of walk into the tax and spend buzzsaw again.
Right.
But it is described as an excise tax, and it ties right into Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which lays out the taxing power of Congress, and it's been recognized for centuries now.
Right.
So I think if the justices are serious about reading the law and deciding this on the law, that's going to be a very big boulder for them to move around.
Yeah, it's really huge. In fact, it's very easy to think of many taxes that could be considered penalties in some sense for inactivity. And the one that comes to mind, I haven't heard it discussed much, but it always comes to mind when I think about this, is the so-called marriage penalty. I mean, we have tax policies that favor married couples in this country. You know, if you go out and get married, you pay less individually in taxes than you would if you're a single person. So effectively, the government is imposing a penalty on you for doing nothing, for staying single. And it's not hard to find such examples in the tax code. So if the court looks at this as a tax, then the answer is going to be very hard to avoid, isn't it?
It is, and that's where I mentioned before, I think it's going to come down to whether they read the law, the Affordable Care Act law, and then follow their own precedents. There's one other avenue here that the courts might look at, and we've seen it bubble up in one of the appellate court decisions, which is a decision basically to punt the ball down the field. President Obama, I think, pretty strategically, is trying to get the court to take this up in an election year.
Yeah, let's talk about that some. This is where I'm gonna tap into some of your political expertise here. I was really almost shocked when I saw the Solicitor General's office pushing this case forward so it'll be heard during an election year. What is up with that? What's the president doing?
Well, there's two things. One is he wants to put the Supreme Court on center stage with both spotlights on. And generally, courts don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone remembers the 2000 decision involving Bush and Gore. And that was a very uncomfortable position. Usually, courts steer away from that sort of high controversy in which its legitimacy is raised to question. So I think Obama is basically putting the court in the spotlight, thinking maybe they'll be more likely either to affirm this decision or to simply rule, as the Fourth Circuit did, that the plaintiffs do not have standing yet. That is, the law doesn't get implemented in a significant way until 2014.
Okay, Larry, hold on just a second. I just want a brief bit of explanation here. What you're saying is the court may not even reach these constitutional issues because there's yet another issue that we call standing that might be the basis for the court just punting the whole case out. And effectively, I'll let you explain it, but effectively, if you don't have standing, it means, at least in this case, that the case is not ready to be heard.
Exactly. And so the question the court might just ask is, who has been compelled so far by the individual mandate to get insurance? And the answer is no one.
Right.
No harm has been done. And that kind of argument is not infrequently used by courts as a way to let a case ripen, to get a better feel for how things are going, to see what kinds of challenges and problems are developing. The court is not precluding the possibility of stepping in at a later point when it has a better idea of what's happening. The judicial decisions below them have really explored the law and maybe identified issues that are not even in front of us at this point.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, you've got a great variety of changes going on in the healthcare marketplace. And for the court to step in the middle of an election year with the presumption that it can kind of sort this out, it's asking a lot. So I think there's a good possibility. I wouldn't say it's likely, but a real possibility that the court may just say, not the right time. Let's keep our gunpowder dry and see how things go and come back at this at another point.
Well, I don't know. I think it might be more likely than you think, because you're right. There are so many circumstances when the court has done exactly that when confronted with a very difficult case. It's just easier to punt and let people come back a few years later. So I don't know. I think I might be inclined to think that they will punt and they will reject the case on the basis of standing. But we'll just have to wait and see, won't we?
We sure will. And certainly this law will be in the spotlight, I think, for years to come.
We can both make careers out of it, can't we?
Yeah, I think there's some books and real stories to tell here.
Thanks very much, Larry Jacobs. We very much appreciate your time today.
Good to be with you.
Okay. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where we're talking about the Affordable Health Care Statute, or, if you prefer, Obamacare. After the break, we'll be talking to Ed White, from the American Center for Law and Justice. Stay tuned.
I don't need no doctor, because I know what's ailing me. I don't need no doctor, no, no, because I know what's ailing me. I've been too long away from a baby.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking about health care. We've already heard from Larry Jacobs of the University of Minnesota, who was very much in favor of the health care statute and thought that it was very clearly constitutional. Now let's hear the other side. Let's hear from Ed White, who's an attorney with the American Center for Law and Justice.
We represent a number of individuals around the country who would be subject to the health care law and asked us to bring a lawsuit challenging that. We filed a lawsuit soon after the law was put into effect. We filed that case in the District of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Just about 2 weeks ago, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against us. They ruled that the individual mandate, that's the part of the health care law that requires fairly pretty much every American citizen to buy and maintain health insurance. So in other words, have to buy a product from a private company for the rest of their lives simply because they're American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And just yesterday, we filed our cert petition with the United States Supreme Court.
Okay, so I take it then that your primary problem, your primary criticism of the health care statute is the so-called individual mandate.
Correct, and also on behalf of two of our clients who are firm believers in faith healing. They do not go to doctors. They do not accept any medical care whatsoever. They just believe in prayer, that it's also violating their religious freedom rights because it's putting a burden on them. In other words, they now have to choose between following their religion or and paying a penalty to the government, or abandoning their religion and buying health insurance, which runs contrary to their religion.
Oh, very interesting. So there's a religious issue here as well. Okay, well, let's take them one at a time then.
Sure.
Why do you believe that the so-called individual mandate, which, if I may characterize it, says that every American must either purchase his own health insurance or pay a tax sort of penalty, why do you find that to be unconstitutional?
For a number of reasons. Primarily that in our 220-some-odd-year history as a country, Congress has never used the power to require American citizens to buy a product from a private company. And as the Supreme Court has said in a number of cases, that in and of itself is strong evidence that Congress doesn't have the power. So in other words, if Congress had this power to require American citizens to buy things, during critical points in our history, they would have used that. So in World War II, they would have required people, for example, to buy war bonds. We were not required, we were encouraged to do it. Just a couple of years right before the Obamacare, as we call it and other people call it, was passed, there was a crisis in our auto industry. I'm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
The auto industry, as you can imagine, is very important in the state of Michigan. And rather than requiring Americans to go out and buy cars to help the auto industry, Congress did what it has always done, is use incentives, the Cash for Clunkers program, to require people if they wanted to, or to allow people if they wanted to, trade in their car to buy a more efficient car. They receive so many thousands of dollars as a credit. And that's one reason right there. But beyond that, too, it's that Congress, if Congress can require American citizens to buy a product from a private company, there's really no limits to what Congress can do. So the challenge to the health care law is not just a complaint or a quibble over, dispute over getting health insurance. It's the allowing Congress to have that power. And in a lot of these cases that have been floating through the court system, I think there was 20-some-odd lawsuits, the federal government has always been asked the question, you know, can Congress require people to buy General Motors cars, because Congress or the federal government had such a large stake in General Motors, or can they require American citizens to buy broccoli, things like that. And for the most part, whenever the Department of Justice attorneys were asked those questions, they always said yes. And most recently, in September, the Middle District of Pennsylvania issued, district court there, that's the trial court, issued an opinion finding the individual mandate unconstitutional and also noting that during oral argument, the Department of Justice attorney acknowledged that there would be not be a limit on Congress. For example, if Congress accepted the premise that an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and put out findings saying that it's good for health, et cetera, you know, can Congress require American citizens to go out and buy apples? The answer was yes, because just under the logic of the individual mandate. And that's the main concern on our behalf. Right now, what the Supreme Court has...
Let me interrupt you, if I may. Just to clarify, we're talking about a power here, primarily, called the commerce power, which gives Congress the power to regulate, among other things, interstate commerce. And as you and I both know, this is a very, very broad power, but it is also a limited power, like all congressional powers. There is some limit somewhere to it. And so what we're arguing about, or what you're arguing about, is... what is that limit, or is there any limit if, in fact, an individual mandate is upheld? So let's talk just a little bit about that. Now, the first thing I think you mentioned was that that particular aspect of the commerce power has not been utilized before. Congress has never required people to buy something. But isn't it true that at least in one or two cases, I'm thinking primarily of Wickard versus Filburn from the early 1940s, that Congress almost effectively required farmers to go out and buy flour or bread or other wheat-based products at local stores because they enforced a limitation on the ability of those farmers to grow wheat for their own home consumption without paying some kind of penalty if they exceeded their quotas. That's probably the case in my mind that comes closest to effectively requiring somebody to either buy a product, in that case bread or flour, or pay a penalty. Now, how would you respond to that? I mean, does Wickard run counter to your arguments or not?
No, because what, in all the Supreme Court cases dealing with the Commerce Clause, you've always had one thing in these cases, which you do not have with the health care situation, is that in all those cases, the people who were subjected to the law that Congress had passed had voluntarily entered the stream of commerce. Wickard, or Filburn, he voluntarily grew wheat. The situations where you had people down south who ran restaurants and hotels but refused to serve certain individuals, African-Americans in particular, they had voluntarily gone into that business. Therefore, they were subject to the controls of Congress. If they did not want to follow the rules that Congress had required, they could have gotten out of the business. They could have stopped running the restaurant or the hotel. And Wickard, Filburn, he put himself into that situation by growing the wheat. Also, the limitations that were placed on Wickard was on the amount of wheat he can grow. That does not require him to go out and buy wheat. It would just, if he wanted to avoid any penalty, he would just have to adjust his lifestyle. He would have to adjust how much wheat he was growing, what he was going to use that wheat for, to comply with the law. Otherwise, he could have just gone, like everyone else, has just followed his own conscience and not been subjected to the law in the sense of, instead of growing wheat, you know, it could have been a soybean farmer or something like that. So I don't think that is a requirement that that's a requirement that's similar to the healthcare law, because the healthcare law would apply to everyone. For example, two of my clients who don't go to the doctor, who do not enter the stream of the health insurance or the healthcare market, they're just sitting around and not doing anything. So in other words, if you have the situation of Filburn, for that to be a true analogy to the individual mandate, would be if Filburn is growing his wheat and he wants to grow an extra acre or two, he then falls within that law at that time. It would apply to him, but it would also apply to the neighbor across the street who, let's say, is growing soybean. The law didn't apply to soybean, but if it did, it would be saying, okay, even though you're a soybean farmer and we're trying to control the price of wheat, if you grow more than whatever of any product, you are now going to be penalized. And the person would sit there and say, wait a second, I'm growing soybean. I'm not growing wheat. And that's the same situation as the people who are objecting to the health care laws. Like, I don't go to the doctor. I am not the problem Congress is trying to solve here. The problem Congress is trying to solve is what they call the free riders, people who mainly, as they noted in their findings, it's mainly a large percentage of the illegal aliens who go to emergency rooms. Emergency rooms have to give you care, and then they don't pay the bill. As a result, then the hospital doctors have to pass the bill on to other patients. If you have a person, for example, two of my clients who don't go to the doctor, they're not passing on any expenses. They're not involved in the healthcare industry, but now they're going to have to pay thousands of dollars every year to buy health insurance from a private company that they have no intention on ever using, or they're going to have to pay a significant penalty. And the whole reason is because they're just American citizens. Filburn, the person who's growing the wheat, he was a farmer.
Okay, I understand there's a certain element of voluntariness in terms of choosing one's vocation, but I think the counterargument that your opponent would probably raise is that, with the exception of some very few people, and you know, I understand you represent a couple of religious objectors, but they're a very tiny minority of people. You know, the vast majority of American citizens will at some point voluntarily enter the healthcare market, maybe not when they're young and healthy, but when they get old and decrepit, or if there's some emergency or if they have an accident, they will eventually enter the market. And so essentially all this is doing is requiring them to pay in a rational basis what they would do, what they're going to do eventually anyway. How do you respond to that argument?
Because for that argument to apply, and that's what the government is trying to say here, is you have to imply all these various inferences. You're going to have to sit there and say, for example, person X, he goes outside, he has a heart attack, he then goes to the doctor treats him, the hospital treats him, he then gets a bill, he then doesn't pay the bill, he doesn't have his friends help him pay the bill. You have to have all these assumptions in there, is that the problem they're trying to solve, these people who are not paying their bills. Just because,
but aren't those rather reasonable assumptions? I mean, doesn't it happen every day?
No, not necessarily. No, because the people who the healthcare law is not directly applying to what it's trying to achieve. So, in other words, it has exempted out. For example, I think it's 19 or 30% of the cost shifting with illegal aliens. They do not comply. They do not have to comply with the law. The poor have now been spread out to have more access to health care through the states because they've increased the Medicaid, and that's a whole separate issue that the states are challenging under a different premise or provision of the Constitution. So if you're looking at what they're trying to, what really is happening here, and the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that found the individual mandate unconstitutional, broke down in very nice fashion that what really is being done here by Congress is it is focusing on the young and the healthy, the people between, let's say, 20 and 30, who normally don't get sick except for, you know, getting hit by lightning or something like that, who don't generally have health insurance because they don't need it. They're now being brought into the system to now pay for the people who now are being fully brought into the system, the sick and the people who are the people with pre-existing conditions, et cetera. And that's why you have the individual mandate. The individual mandate is to bring these people into the system, even though they don't want to go into the system. But even with that, you're still going to have financial problems because you cannot keep up with the goals that Congress is trying to achieve here, the financial goals here. But what I want to make clear here is that everyone is sitting there and is looking at this law. And even the Department of Justice attorneys who have been thinking about this, they've been arguing this in cases throughout the country, they can never come up with true limits to the power that Congress would have here. And that is the problem. Even in the District of Columbia case that we had, that we just had the ruling on a couple of weeks ago, even there, the majority, the two judges in the majority, admit that their decision means that there is no limits to congressional power, which runs contrary to Supreme Court case law that says there has to be limits under the Commerce Clause. And that at least in our case, those two judges admit right up front, saying, look, we understand now Congress can do pretty much anything it wants under the Commerce Clause. And that should be a concern for every American, whether they want health insurance or not. It's that now you have a congressional power under the Commerce Clause that runs completely contrary to what the Founding Fathers had established, where you're going to have Congress would have limited powers, the rest of the powers would go to the states. And that should be a major concern, because that is going to topple the system of government that we've been living under for the past 220-some-odd years.
No, I'll agree with you that all enumerated congressional powers are in some sense limited. And, of course, the commerce power is limited to those things that are either directly commerce themselves or that, as the case law says, you know, substantially affect commerce. And I agree that there is a very significant issue here as to what where one would draw the line on Congress's ability to purchase items. But I think the response that the government has made thus far is that, yeah, theoretically, the government could require everybody to buy a GM car. Theoretically, the government could require everybody to buy broccoli. But as a practical matter, it's extraordinarily unlikely that Congress would ever do that because, in fact, health care is special. Health care insurance is special because an insurance market requires broad-based participation in order to spread the risk properly, whereas these other markets, they simply don't require it as a matter of economic viability. Now, how would you respond to that?
Well, they would require it because the main argument the government will always say is that, as you even pointed out, you know, virtually everyone needs health care at one point in their life. Well, everyone needs to eat. It's not virtually everyone needs to eat. And just as in the Wickard case you talk about where Congress is meddling in the free market trying to regulate the prices of wheat because they said it was a national problem, there's absolutely no reason why Congress couldn't say we have a national problem in for corn or something else, and people need to go out there and buy the corn. Congress can't require people to eat it, but Congress can require you to go out there and buy it. And if Congress has the power to require American citizens because it can come up with some national crisis and comes up with findings, and for example, my example of the auto industry, under Congress's theory, and they admit, even in the Florida case, their own attorney admitted, sure, Congress could require you to go out and buy a General Motors car if you meet a certain annual income. You know, they can't require a poor person to do it, but let's say you make $150,000 a year. They can make a requirement that every 5 years you need to buy a new American car because it's going to help the economy. And if Congress can require a person to go out and buy an apple, okay, which costs, a dime or a quarter or something like that, then Congress can make you do anything.
Well, Ed White was pretty sure of his position. He definitely thinks that this new Obamacare, as he called it, is unconstitutional for a variety of reasons, but of course primarily because of the individual mandate. And I'm looking back at my former student, Drew Taylor.
Drew, how are you doing, Professor?
I'm doing really well. Now, you had a chance now to think about this and listen to these opposing arguments and do some research of your own. Where do you come down on this health care statute?
Well, Professor, that's a great question. In class, you taught us that our laws are based upon one central document, which is the Constitution. And I think if you can make peace with the Constitution, I think that that kind of law should be allowed. However, you always have to deal with the sticky 10th Amendment issue. Amendment being that any sort of rights that aren't specifically taken by the federal government are going to be retained by the state. And here it reminds
you're
me...
You're a states' rights kind of guy, aren't you?
Well, I'm a constitutional kind of guy, Professor. And this situation reminds me a lot of Christmas, where my brother would say, "Hey, Drew, you can play with the Game Boy until I want the Game Boy back," right? So I have that Game Boy all day long until my brother wants it. At a certain point, it ceases to be my Game Boy. I think we have the same issue here. And in terms of the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court is not the final court because it's infallible. It's infallible because they're the final court. They're the final say.
All right. So I guess the 10th Amendment gives you pause. Okay. Well, you have the final word today, Drew. And I'd like to thank very much Ed White of the American Center for Law and Justice. I'd like to thank Larry Jacobs of the University of Minnesota. And, of course, my executive producer, Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.